This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
Patients would have to take their passports to hospital as part of a clampdown on health tourism. For the first time, hospitals will be told to ensure everyone proves they are entitled to free NHS treatment. Those at outpatients clinics and in A&E will have to fill in forms stating their passport number and expiry date and say how much time they've spent abroad if they're to be admitted onto a ward. Really? Do you really see this happening? The measures are part of a government drive to stop migrants and tourists abusing the health service. Hospitals have been given guidelines from the Department of Health telling them they have a legal obligation to ensure they identify anyone not entitled to free treatment. Trusts which fail to charge so-called health tourists will be hit with financial penalties worth thousands of pounds. That's a good idea. So a cash-strapped hospital that hasn't got enough money for patients fails, and they, of course they should check. So then they have to pay out even more money. It's going well, isn't it? To give you the legal situation at the moment, only those who've been living in the UK for at least 6 months are eligible for hospital treatment on the NHS. But receptionists, doctors and nurses often assume all patients referred by a GP are entitled to their procedures on the health service and do not bother to ask for documents. One newspaper, the Daily Mail, gives an extraordinary example of this, of Bimbo Ayelabola, who's 33. She's a Nigerian woman who flew to Britain while pregnant. She had quintuplets on the NHS, and it cost us £200,000. She applied for a six-month visitor visa after discovering she was pregnant and moved to the UK to stay with her sister in East London. She gave birth by caesarean section in April, a couple of years ago, stayed at the Homerton Hospital in East London for almost 2 weeks. The babies were born at 32 weeks. They received care in a premature baby unit that cost £35,000 a week. The mum said she didn't have the means to pay. However, it appears her husband was a wealthy businessman who owned a logistics company and a hotel and a business centre in Lagos. Maternity care in Nigeria is free, but standards are low. Mortality rates are high. Last night, the paper points out, it's still unclear if the she or Nigeria had paid for her care, but they understand the bill remains unpaid. Will this make any difference, this crackdown? Roger Goss is co-director of Patient Concern. Will your members be celebrating this news?
No, because although there is a problem, and I don't know what the answer is, I can't quite see how the proposal to produce your passport is going to work. One, plenty of people don't have a passport.
Yep.
Two, carrying it about with you when you're old and frail, especially if you're going into somewhere like A&E, doesn't seem like a good idea for safety reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Three, if you're then instead asked to quote its number, date of expiry or date of issue and so on and so forth, who carries that information in their head?
No, absolutely not. I
think it's extremely difficult. I could see why they want to do something. I'm going to make a political comment, like politicians do, which is pretty pointless.
You're not going to necessarily support one party, are you?
It's amazing that when the NHS was originally set up, they didn't find some sort of system, you know, that everybody would be identified. Could identify themselves easily as eligible. But, of course, at that time, there wasn't the immigration.
Yeah.
And there wasn't a European Union with free movement of people between countries.
Yes.
So yeah. I suppose, saw it as quite the major problem that it really is. And to be fair, they did... I don't know if it was originally when the NHS was founded. We have got this NHS number, which is about 150 digits and letters, you know. I don't know what my NHS is.
No, I don't either. I don't know yours, obviously. I don't know mine. It's I know my son. One of my sons required his, and I've managed to find it. It's quite a lengthy thing. It's a lot more difficult to remember than your army number. Mr. Goss, thank you. You're co-director of Patient Concern. Let's turn to Mike Travis, who's with the Royal College of Nursing. So that's the patient side. Mr. Travis, let's come from the clinicians and the professional side. How will they respond to it?
I think it's going to be a very difficult issue to introduce at a point of clinical need. And I think there is always a need to make sure that you are, that people receive the care that they're entitled to.
Mm.
But if they're going to rely on doctors and nurses to check this, then that's exactly the wrong place to be checking it, because at that point of time, that's when
So where is the right spot, would you say, then?
Well, I think the right spot starts with immigration control. When you're registering for healthcare, it depends on what group that you're talking about, because when we talk about immigration, we never really define what we're talking about. Are we talking about European Union patients? And people have to realise that when we're tourists over in Europe,
yeah,
we can get our healthcare needs paid by our government, and that's a well set up
procedure. Yep.
And then there's the irregular migrants,
yep,
people who are coming over here to work, and they might get the period of notice over a number of years or
right,
a period of time. And then what do you mean by health tourists? And then in Liverpool, where I come from, of course, the government's putting a lot of migrants who are at the point of the final appeal into Liverpool to come and hear their appeals. And so we have a big group of people there as well.
So
could technically... So the thing is that what are we actually talking about when we say migrants?
Well, just lastly then, you don't see it as a problem?
I think there's always a problem. I think you should always be accountable for the public money that you pay. But by citing nurses and doctors as being the final key holders or gate masters to care, we're the wrong group. Our responsibility is to ensure that we deliver care that's safe and that we concentrate on the patient at the time that we are delivering care.
All right. Thank you, Mike Travis. You're with the Royal College of Nursing. So there's the idea from the patients and, of course, the professional side. Now from you and your views, it doesn't seem a great idea. I wonder if there's anyone out there, actually, who's already been asked to produce their passport when they've attended a hospital or outpatients. Because it would seem, particularly if you then get detained, because they advise you not to leave any valuables, so maybe relatives or friends take your watch and your wallet and your rings or whatever else it might be. But you've got to go in with your passport. And if you're elderly, it doesn't matter. It's trying, whatever age you are. I can imagine if you need treatment, you've lost your passport. And as one of my contributors said, it's not illegal not to have a passport. Double negative. You don't need to have a passport to live in this country. And there will be people who don't use passports. They never leave Britain. Not crime. And with a wide, broad tableau of different faces and people behind her, Hillary Clinton announces, I don't think it was particularly secret, that she's running to be president. But, of course, I remind you, we have been here before. Dr. James Boyes is US political analyst and author of Clinton's Grand Strategy. Second time lucky, what do you reckon?
Yeah, I think you've got to you'd be a wise man to put money on Hillary at the moment, to be honest, Nick. She's got a very easy field, I think, ahead of her for the Democratic Party's nomination. And then, you know, as with all candidates, it's... what was Harold Macmillan's famously say? It's events, dear boy, events. You know, will things play her way? Will she avoid scandal? And who will she run against from the Republicans in the November 2016 election?
Well, we'll come to that in just a second, because I think it's another last name that we all know so well. When we look at where the Democratic Party was before Barack Obama, as he was now President Obama, rocketed to superstardom, how's the Democratic Party at the moment, would you say?
I think one of the great problems it has here is the fact that, 20, 25 years after Bill Clinton became president, we're still talking about the Clintons. There's an awful lot of people who want to talk about dynasties, the Bushes, the Clintons. But really, one of the challenges here is where's everybody else? The bench strength in American politics at the moment is really rather woeful, particularly within the Democratic Party. If Hillary had said yesterday, I'm not running, who on earth was going to pick up the baton on the Democratic Party side of things? No one expects Joe Biden to be a serious candidate at this point. So it would almost have been handing the nomination and the presidency to the Republicans in 2016.
Supporters will point to the fact that she's been a first lady, she's been a senator, she's been a governor's wife, she's been immersed in politics since the year dot. But opponents will say, through all of that, she still appears, I think I can use this word, quite cold.
No, you're absolutely right. There's no doubt about it that when you look at the Bill and Hillary relationship, she has the sort of the intellectual nous and the calculation, and he had all the typical Southern charm. What she really needs to do is find a way to break through that so that both in the United States and over here on this side of the Atlantic, There was a sense that she has a sense of personality and warmth, and that is something which she hasn't managed to achieve yet. I've seen her speak in person in small groups. Whether she can do it on the national stage is another issue.
How much of an asset or otherwise might Bill be?
I've always thought that Bill Clinton has been her greatest asset and could be her greatest liability. In 2008, there was all sorts of concerns that Hillary might have secured the nomination, headed into the November election, expecting to win, and then some sort of bombshell would explode about Bill Clinton having some sort of a continuing relationship. There were certain rumours at that point about a Canadian journalist. So the fear is that for all her hard work and her life's ambition of becoming president could be undone by the man who's been by her side all these years.
Dear, oh dear. And all these years, lastly, you talk about that, Doctor, all these years on, we potentially are going to have Bush v. Clinton yet again. There's 280 million Americans. Can't they find anybody else?
Well, this is my point at the top of of our talk, this idea that people are focusing upon the Clintons and the Bushes as though that's the problem. The problem actually is the fact that in the last 20 or 25 years, so few politicians have emerged in the United States of a credible nature to really challenge these two. So it's really a question of default, I think, at this point, Nick.
This is Nick Ferrari with more to come as I look back at my week on breakfast. This is LBC. This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
To the extraordinary story of the grandmother who's 5 months pregnant at the age of 65 with quadruplets. Quadruplets, she's having quads is the easier way, isn't it, really? Quads. She already has 13 children by five different fathers. That is worth going through again, actually, isn't it? Annegret Raunig is 65. Has 13 children by five different men. She's 65 and she's now 5 months pregnant with four children on the way. She last gave birth when she was 55 and underwent fertility treatment because the girl, Layla, now nine, said she wanted a little brother or sister. Oh, well, that's the reason to do it. What happens when the next lot come out? The mother also has seven grandchildren and her oldest child is 44. This is just weird. Said, it was a shock, I had to do some thinking, but she's pressed ahead. I feel fit, I don't think I will have any problems. She lives in Berlin, she had 18 months of fertility treatment. Well, how can she be surprised that she's pregnant then? She had 18 months of fertility treatment and was artificially inseminated with both donated sperm and eggs. The identity of the father is unknown. And she's a primary school teacher? Man, we thought we had problems here. This is just this is absolutely irresponsible. There's no way that this woman should be proceeding with this, is there? Josephine Quintavalle is director of CORE, Comment on Reproductive Ethics, and joins me now. Should this be allowed to happen?
Hello?
Hello, you're on the radio. Should this be continuing? Should this woman be able to get this sort of treatment at her age?
Well, she's obviously had it, and one of the people we should be speaking to are the doctors who cobbled us all up together. I think you have to continually underline that she's used donated eggs and donated sperm. It's not her biological child. When I read the story, I checked the date in the paper. I thought, is it April the 1st? I didn't think there could be a situation that I hadn't faced in answering questions about the ethics of these issues until this came up. It's absolutely the most appalling story I've ever heard. And I think the doctors who did it should be the ones who are being interviewed. They should be asking, did you ever take on board the interests of the children who'd be born from this? I mean, one has to hope now that the pregnancy goes to term, but a quad pregnancy at any age is very dangerous. And at the age of 65, it could, you know, it could be fatal. I mean, hopefully not. We don't wish that on her, but it's significant. Also, quads are usually born prematurely. They have much more difficulty health-wise than a singleton pregnancy. But I think women have to grow up and understand that our fertility, unlike male fertility, peaks and dips. And once we can't produce children naturally is the time when we should stop.
Josephine, please hang on the line, bring someone else into the conversation.
Jane English. Now, may I call you Jane? Is that all right?
Yes, of course.
You've
yes,
had, you've used IVF successfully, I'm pleased to say.
Yes.
You had children. You had children in your 40s, so congratulations.
I did. In fact, I'll just clarify something. I had my first daughter 2 months before I was 40, so my 30s, please.
I'm so sorry. But you're...
No, I had my second daughter when I was 43.
43. What
and
about
I'm now? Yeah. I don't mind exposing, you know, my age.
Go on.
I'm now nearly 56, and okay. I have a 12-year-old daughter.
Okay. Could so, you imagine you doing? Know, this is... Could you imagine doing all this at 65?
No. I mean, I think to be fair, I struggled probably a little bit when I was 43. You know, I didn't have the same amount of energy.
Mm.
People say you're more patient. I don't know whether you are more patient. I don't know whether I was more patient. I've got two little ones. I've got nobody to help me. And, you know, to be fair, it was a struggle. But I think also the other issue here is that, you know, how old, you know, our life expectancy is increasing, I know. But, you know, at the age of 65, one does start, I think, to see one's mortality looming.
Yep.
Is it fair to the child that they may have to actually go through grief as a fairly young person? You know, I worry about my own mortality in terms of my own daughter, my 12-year-old and my 16-year-old. I think they need me.
So,
the other thing I think which is quite important is that because she has other children,
yeah,
she is, if you like, they're caught in a trap, the other children, because at some point they may well have to become the parent to their very young siblings.
But hasn't this woman got emotional... She's got really emotional health issues more than gynecological needs. Well, she does, doesn't she?
Well,
she's
I 60. Must admit...
She's got 13 children.
When I heard this story, I did think that maybe there's some kind of addiction there. And at some point, if there is an addiction, and after having 13 children, you know, now potentially 17, I think that... Maybe there are mental health issues, perhaps.
Let's bring Josephine back into the comment. Josephine, what is the, if it is a legal age, which IVF is no longer available? At what age is it deemed to be you're too old?
Honestly, I'm sorry you're catching me out on that, but I think we all do, we do know, and it has to be underlined, that women are born with a specific number of eggs. We don't go on recreating them.
Mm.
And you start to run out of eggs. I'm making this very simple as a, you know, so people can understand
easily.
Yeah,
no, do it for me.
Round about 35, we start to dip. Right. And, of course, women can have children naturally later than that as well, but not at 65. It just simply doesn't happen. We run out of eggs.
Jane English, what should be the maximum age, the oldest age at which you can avail yourself of IVF?
Oh, that's a really tricky one. I mean, I really do think that it depends on the individual, but certainly I think if one looks at scientific evidence, the eggs become less viable as one gets older. And also, there's an increased danger of some kind of perhaps disability in the child. So, I mean, I think it's very hard to put a date on it. Plus, there are some people, for example, excuse me, I didn't start ovulating until I was 26.
Right.
So therefore, gynecologically, and I was much, much younger than my chronological age. So my eggs were still at the age of, they were taken from me, about 36. They told me there were still a lot of eggs there. They were still very much viable. So I think really it depends on the individual.
Well, here we are. The NHS, say until 42.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, I think that really, you know, one actually has to have a cut-off line, certainly at, for me, it would have been 45.
45 would be you.
For me, it would have been 45.
Josephine?
Yes.
Josephine?
Well, yes, I mean, I think there are variables, and I totally agree. We're not all exactly the same, but I think what we have to underline here is that this German grandmother did not use her own eggs. That's absolutely clear. She used donor eggs, so she exposed some other woman to the process of harvesting eggs, which is an invasive process. At 65, it's a non-starter. It's not her own eggs.
Mm.
So we do have variables, but in general, if you look at fertility rates after 35 in assisted reproduction, you'll notice that it starts to dip. We do start to run out.
But standard IVF, for want of a better expression, on NHS, 42, 45, what would you say there?
Well, the thing is you can go around the private clinics, that's on the NHS. But there's certainly an acknowledgement in the NHS that fertility dips. But I think here the thing that shocked everybody is the 65. Nobody has any hesitation about saying that's far too old.
Thank you to Jane English, who has two children through IVF, one born in her late 30s, one in her early 40s. Thanks, Jane. And Josephine Quindavalli, Director of Core Commitment. Comment on reproductive ethics. So what age should be that cut-off age? We'll get into that in more detail. I think probably my two contributors there, we'd all, broadly speaking, agree. 65. And again, it's not, I'm sorry to be fairly brutal about this, but it's neither her eggs nor anyone she knows sperm, to put it politely. She's got 13 children already. This woman's problems, I would politely suggest, lie in her head, not in her reproductions. And it's wholly irresponsible. 65. Four kids on the way. So let's work this out. So she will be in her mid-70s when they come out of primary school. She'll be probably about 77 by the time all that goes through. She'll be approaching 80. And all the other kids' mums will be like sort of 25 or something like that. No, they won't. So it'll be about 30 odd by then. That's just absurd, isn't it? Terry's in Cobham. Hi, Terry.
Good morning, Nick. Well, you should be brutal. It's absolutely disgusting. The doctors should be prosecuted. It's totally unethical, and these are my reasons why. I have seven children, the youngest of which is 19. Funny enough, exactly what you, the age those ladies said.
Yep.
45. I was 45 when I had them, right?
Yep.
They're not exhausting, obviously, because they're adults now.
Mm-hmm.
And they're good. We have grandchildren. And forget about toddlers being exhausting. Imagine babies, having babies that age. She's my age.
Yeah.
And also, and I think you've just said it, when she's 80, then poor children, and I'm using that word, poor children, let someone come on your radio station and argue, then poor children would be 15 years of age. She's going to curse her other children with them looking after them. Some might say it's a blessing. Well, it's not. It's a blessing if you ask for it, or it happens to you. They're not even her eggs. They're not even, the sperm's not any from anyone she knows. Mm. It's be brutal, Nick. It's disgusting, and they should be nicked for it. It's as simple as that. It's totally unethical.
This is Nick Ferrari. More highlights of my week on breakfast after the news. This is LBC. This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
Fascinating story on the front page of the Financial Times, which actually is often the home to fascinating stories, and one we talked about briefly in our first hour in the review of the newspapers. Problems with Google. Here's a question for you. I promise I will tell you the truth. It's nothing, by the way, embarrassing. What did you last Google? When you last Googled, what was it that you Googled, whether professionally or personally? I'll tell you what mine was in just a moment. It was just last night. I'm not crash hot, as you know, in this. Well, getting better at the world of the internet. I do actually send quite a lot of emails now. But I only know Google. I've just been speaking to some of my colleagues. I was told somebody could ask Jeeves. I didn't know what it was. There are others out there. I suppose I'm advertising, aren't I, by saying I'm happy. I suppose I'd be careful. There are others out there. Give me the name of another one, guys. Who? Bing. Bing. Right, there we are. There's don't talk to me like that. There's Bing, there's Ask Jeeves, and there's others. But Google is huge. And as the FT points out today, Google will stand accused in Brussels of illegally abusing its dominance of the internet search market in Europe. That could ultimately force it to change its business model and possibly pay hefty fines. Let's speak to one of the authors of the piece in the FT, Alex Barker. He's EU correspondent for the FT, and along with colleagues, he has the splash today. This is just being penalised for success, isn't it, Alex?
Well, Google will certainly say that. They have been under investigation for like 5 years. It's taken a very long time. But the charge is basically that they've been using their muscle to squeeze out rivals and competitors, not the likes of Bing, but more comparison shopping sites,
right,
maps, travel sites, things like that, where they're offering Google's own services, you know, Google Shopping, and promoting those at the top of the results page, instead of a rival that might be providing a better service.
How seriously will Google take this, in your view?
Very, very. I mean, they're putting a lot of effort and money to avoid this. They tried to settle for about 3 years. There was a huge kind of political fight in Brussels, and they'll be upset that it's come to this. And because, you know, they're fighting a lot of regulators around the world, and this is the first time that anyone's formally said, you know, you've broken the law. And it could be the start of something much bigger. Antitrust cases like this in Brussels tend to morph and kind of become a bit Medusa-like. And there'll be other claims that they've violated laws in other areas. And, you know, Microsoft were tangled up in this for about 10 years. They ended up paying a couple of billion in fines. And, you know, the EU has quite far-reaching powers to be able to say, you know, this is what you can do as a big business and this is what you can't do. And, you know, Google's on the road to that now.
I appreciate, and I remind everyone, you're in Brussels for the FT, so I'm taking you perhaps a little bit away from your area of speciality. But how have they done it, Alex? How have Google become so big?
Well, I mean, they mastered search by basically being able to marshal more data and provide better and more precise search than any of their rivals. And then they ended up in a position where, 90% of searches in Europe are running through them. What the trouble is with big tech cases like this is that the regulators kind of sniff a bit of, problems and violations in a big case to follow, but they tend to be a bit behind the curve. And Google are saying, well, look, you know, we might be dominant in search, but how about eBay? How about Amazon on things like shopping? You know, people search through Twitter, find products through that. And the internet is forever changing in a way that often the kind of regulatory fights don't really keep up with. And so we might see, you know, in 5-10 years' time, they'll be fined and told to do certain things, and by then, you know, Google Shopping will be long forgotten.
Lastly, what happens next in this story then? Is there an actual date where the Europe takes a look at this, or does Google now have to file papers? What happens?
It's basically kind of like a court, but the European Commission, which is the top competition agency, is like the judge, the jury, the investigator, and what happens now is they've been charged. Google have a chance to put their kind of defence over the next 10 weeks. They can have a hearing where they explain why they didn't do anything wrong. And ultimately, it's down to the commission to decide whether they infringe the rules. And they can say, look, you pay these fines, you have to do this. And after that, Google can then appeal and take it to court. And it's a very long process. This could take, you know, another couple of years before there's a decision. And then you're in the courts for, you know, 5-10 years after that.
Fascinating. Thanks. Read all about it in the Financial Times today. Alex Barker is one of the authors of the piece on the front page. He's the EU correspondent for the FT, all about Google. Now, what was the last subject you Googled, and can you imagine a world without Google? I can see that if there are anti-competitive issues, if they are effectively able to swamp smaller companies trying to set up, then that is a little bit unfair, but surely they've managed to get where they are by being so extraordinarily efficient. I find it incredible. The thing that I Googled, right, was, this is so boring. I wish I could make something up. It was car rental, right? I need to hire a car somewhere in the world. So I put in the name, and I didn't even go for one of the regular firms. You can put in these comparative sites. And it was incredible. There were thousands and thousands of searches being done in front of me with little logos popping up. I know I sound like an elderly person, but this is incredible. All you do is you put in that Google, you just put in car rental in, and then pow, everything happens. This is fantastic. I didn't even know that there were other search engines, but I do realise now, effectively, that Google is a verb. It's a bit like a Hoover. In Britain, when it comes, you should actually say, well, why don't you vacuum clean your front room? Someone would say, well, have you hoovered the front room? It has become that huge. But why would we step in the way? Well, it's Europe, isn't it? Why would Europe seek to step in the way of something that has been so universally successful? So, for those of you who are occasional users of the internet, or those of you who are constantly using the internet, what did you last put into the Google search engine? How would the world be without Google? And have you tried some of these other companies that my colleagues are just whispering in my ear? Ask Jeeves, Bing, and something else I'm told, which is Yahoo. We will be in appreciation of them all, and we'll be hearing what your last search was. as Europe in the shape of Brussels gets ready to charge, and it will be billions if, of course, Google are found to have broken any European restrictions or regulations, you will be talking out a multi-billion euro payout as they challenge their market dominance. Right, life without Google, or in praise of Google, or some of its competitors such as Bing and others. Right, in praise of Google, or do you come to bury it? Let's speak first with James in Camberwell. James, you're on the radio. Hello.
Hey, Nick. Good morning.
James, I've got a list of 20 fascinating facts about Google here. Could I ask you to give me a number between 1 and 20?
Well, I wasn't waiting for this. I'll have a roll.
Just a number between 1 and 20,
James. Oh, a number. All right, 17.
Number 17. Google rents out goats from a company called California Grazing to help cut down the amount of weeds and brush at Google HQ. The operation of 200 goats plus a herder and a border collie is kinder to the environment, and Google puts it a lot cuter to watch them than lawnmowers. Your point on Google. When was the last thing you Googled something?
It'd be just about a half an hour ago.
What was it you Googled?
I Googled awards to... I'm missing a couple of awards for a song called The D-Day Dodgers.
Right. Why did you need to know that?
On Friday night, we run a music club in Ripley in Surrey, and
oh,
on
yes.
Friday night, we got a gentleman who'd be 99.
Oh, wow.
And he served in the 8th Army from North Africa up
right.
to Italy into France, and he likes the tune Lily Marleen.
He likes the tune Lily of... oh, right, yes.
Lily Marleen, underneath the... You know,
no, yes, I've got it. No, that's fine. Now, before Google, I think it's about 17 years old, Google. Before Google, what would you have done? How would you have got that?
Well, you'd probably... we all know the song sort of thing, but you'd probably have to look out old cassettes or tapes or get all records out. Now you can just type in the lyrics and up it comes.
Yeah. Or, of course, you'd go to a library, wouldn't you? Which would be...
Yeah.
That would be a great thing, wouldn't it?
No. Nothing wrong with going to libraries.
No.
Children all go to libraries, but...
yeah, you're right.
For 1 or 2 minutes, it's not worth it.
All right. OK, listen, thank you for that. Good luck. When are you doing something for him? This Friday, did you say?
Friday evening in Ripley Village Hall, yeah.
All right, I hope it goes well. Have a good celebration, thank you. Here's another thing from my top 20 things about Google. There's a lot to do with animals in Google. Google advocates bringing dogs to work, and they have a company dog called Yoshka. Yoshka accompanies Urs Holzler, the senior VP operations and Google fellow to the Googleplex. Wow, it's all a bit like the moon is over there in a sense, isn't it? They're all drinking the Kool-Aid. Having goats as lawnmowers and taking dogs to work. Dear God, imagine that. I don't think I fit in particularly well at Google, but they're unlikely to invite me, so you won't worry too much. Right, more of your calls on Google in just a second. At the end, sadly, and pay tribute to Percy Sledge. He's died at his home in Louisiana. He had liver cancer diagnosed more than a year ago. He survived by his wife and children. His career spanned almost half a century, beginning with a ballad which appeared in movies as well as a popular Levi jeans advert. He did have other hits, but this is probably the one he'll be best known for. His early life saw him work in the cotton fields around his hometown in Alabama before becoming a hospital nurse in the early 60s. He also spent weekends playing with a rhythm and blues band called the Esquires. A patient at the hospital heard him singing while working and recommended him to a record producer, Quinn Ivey. The rest, as they say, is history. That song you're hearing now was a number one around the world, but it's not his only hit. Sound, isn't it? Simon Warner is an author. He recently released Text and Drugs and Rock and Roll. That was a couple of years ago. He teaches popular music at the University of Leeds, and he joins me now for an appreciation of Percy Sledge. How big a star was he in your book, Simon?
Well, Nick, he was one of a gallery of great soul singers in the 1960s. Percy Sledge was one of the important performers at the time, and this song, this 1966 song, absolutely left his imprint on on the world of popular music, and I think it remains in our hearts and heads even today.
This is Nick Ferrari with more to come as I look back at my week on Breakfast. This is LBC. This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on Breakfast here on LBC.
Each week during the election campaign, we're giving you the chance to question a senior politician about the issues that matter to you. We'll be hearing from all the main parties as Britain decides. This morning, we're joined by the Deputy Prime Minister, Nick Clegg, leader also of the Liberal Democrats. Mr. Clegg, good morning to you. Where are you today?
Good morning. I'm in the northwest. I'm in Salford. Ah.
Found a voter again.
So, yeah, chasing down every prospective Lib Dem voter is being approached.
Must be wonderful in every corner of the country. Party leader actually knock on the door and introduce himself in this fashion.
It's called a personal touch. It's called a personal touch.
All right, let's get straight to these questions, Mr. Clegg. David is in Enfield, and you're the first through to the Deputy Prime Minister. Go ahead, David.
Good morning, Nick. Good morning, Mr. Clegg.
Morning, David.
Mr. Clegg, my question relates to the child abuse scandal. It's two parts. On the 23rd of February this year, your party, supported by the Conservatives, voted against an amendment to the Serious Crime Bill proposed by Labour MP John Mann to protect police officers from prosecution under the Official Secrets Act. This vote took place at 9:15 in the evening and went unreported at the time. So my first point is, why did you not support this proposal? Then my second question is, according to the local newspapers in Sheffield, between 2001 and 2013, 660 girls, some as young as 12, suffered serious sexual abuse in Sheffield, to which the authorities turned a blind eye. Now, the town has a number of Liberal Democrat councillors, and you're a local MP. Were you aware of what was going on?
So, David, on the latter point, of course, are you asking, was I aware back in 2001 about the allegations of this very serious and horrific.
Well, this is going on.
Clearly not. I mean, sorry. Of course not. I mean, I'm as shocked as anybody else. Not just with that revelation about what was happening in South Yorkshire, Rotherham, and Sheffield, or alleged to be happening, but also elsewhere in the country. And that the way in which, you know, with each passing month, the lid appears to be being lifted on a kind of pattern of. You know, large-scale abuse, which is unimaginable to any sort of normal person, and seems to be happening in different parts of the country. No, of course I wasn't aware of it. And I, like you, no doubt, David, I want to see the truth come out. I want to see the police now get to the bottom of what happened, and I want to see the perpetrators punished. On the Serious Crime Bill amendment, David, forgive me. As you can imagine, there are lots and lots of amendments which are always sort of put forward to bits of legislation as they pass through Parliament. And in this case, I guess Theresa May would have taken a view, I'm assuming, but I can check for you if you like. I can check with the Home Office. Would have taken a view that the protections, at least the way you describe it to me, are sufficient to allow any police officer to come forward. And I would certainly urge not only police officers, but anybody who has any information to come forward and do so without any fear of recrimination or any fear of any impact on their livelihood or their careers. But I can, if you wish, David, try and find out the detail about whether John Mann's amendment really did meet that test or not.
What response from you, David?
I find that unbelievable because the amendment was very clear. And in fact, your MPs voted overwhelmingly with the Conservatives against passing that amendment, which was supported by all the Labour MPs and one or two dissenting Conservative and Liberal Democrat MPs. I find it amazing you're not aware of it.
Well, you shouldn't be that amazed, David, in the sense that it is a very, very important issue. You and I are not going to disagree that we want particularly retired police officers who feel that they have information which can cast more light on these terrible allegations to come forward and do so without any fear of any impact on their livelihood, on their pensions, on their retirement arrangements and so on. The suggestion there's any dissent with that, of course, is not the case. Everybody wants the same thing. I am assuming, but I can only assume, David, I'm just being very open with you, I can only assume that the Home Office judged that John Mann's amendment was either not sort of didn't quite fit the bill, might not have been technically correct, or that there are provisions elsewhere in the bill or even other amendments which met the same objective. But if I may, I will make sure that someone gets, or I get back to you with more details about that particular amendment.
Mr. Gogo, I don't know if you've yet had sight of the front page of the Times, but it is reported that Alison Saunders, the Director of Public Prosecutions, will announce today it would not be in the public interest to put on trial formerly Greville, now Lord Jenner of Braunston QC, the former MP for Leicester West, for historical abuse allegations. This is the second time that he would escape charges. He, of course, denies all these allegations. Is it in the public interest not to proceed?
Well, that, as you know, is not a judgment for... It's precisely right that that is a judgment for the Crown Prosecution Service and for the DPP.
Seems to be at odds with what Ms. Saunders said last year. They would pursue justice for victims whether it took 30 days or 30 years.
Yes, but the problem you and I have is that we don't know, if I understand it correctly... She hasn't yet made an announcement, and she were to make that announcement, I'm assuming she would explain her reasons, because everybody would be entitled.
Appear possibly, sadly, Lord Jenner is in poor health.
Well, I don't know what the DPP is going to say about this. She is entirely independent. I don't know what reasons she might give if she were to decide that they can't proceed with this case, but in a justice system, in a democratic society, it is quite right that it is not up to the whims and wishes of politicians. It is up to the prosecuting authorities to pursue justice without fear or favour. And just as you've alluded to yourself, I've been impressed with what she said about the need for the long arm of justice to reach across time, across space, to do so, even if it reaches up to the highest reaches of British society and the British establishment. And she has a reputation for doing so fearlessly. So if she were to decide otherwise in this particular case, I'm assuming she will explain why. But we're going to have to wait until we hear that explanation to know more.
Well, we don't have to wait to hear this. In an LBC exclusive in the previous hour, a former undercover Metropolitan Police officer has said he was forced to release five men who admitted being part of a paedophile ring with the late Liberal MP Cyril Smith. He's known as John. The officer said the men admitted to being involved with Smith. We've disguised his voice. Here's a little of what he told us.
He was part of shared their interests, and that they had been with him on occasions elsewhere. Certainly that there'd been in establishments where Cyril Smith was there and where that sort of activity was taking place. It was reported back, obviously. Had to be reported to the senior officers at the time, the senior investigating officer. And I assume that he then had to report that elsewhere. Very shortly after that, the inquiry was closed.
So they've told you that they've been involved in this?
Yes.
They've told you that they've been involved in this with an MP?
Yes.
Suddenly the whole thing gets shut down?
Yes.
What are you doing within the Liberal Democrat Party to investigate claims regarding the late Liberal MP Cyril Smith?
Well, we will cooperate, of course.
No, but what are you doing within the Liberal Democrat Party itself?
Well, let me be very clear. The chap John you just talked, you just played the excerpt. What is really shocking is he said that he reported it up to his senior officers. He then said, I think he used the phrase, they reported it elsewhere, I guess further up the chain within the police, and that for some reason then the police, someone, somewhere in the chain of command, decided not to pursue the inquiry. So very, very serious questions, of course, need to be asked now about why on earth the police didn't do what, at that time, what they are supposed to do, which is to investigate evidence of crime where that is presented to them, as it clearly was in this case. And if the police didn't do so in the past, they must do so now, and I'm sure they are. And the Liberal Democrats, and indeed anybody else who's got any information, should make that available to the police. And that's what we could. No organisation can replace the police. And the police must now do the job which clearly wasn't done by the police in the past. I clearly don't know why the police and in what way the police were discouraged from pursuing that inquiry. I've written to all Liberal Democrat MPs and all peers and to tell them to cooperate fully with the police if they're approached by the police.
But why not hold your own inquiry, lastly?
Well, for starters, the allegations about Cyril Smith actually stretch back to a time when he was a Labour politician rather than a Liberal Democrat. Mm. Then he was a Liberal politician, a party which then became subsumed into what is now the Liberal Democrats. As I say, what I can do, what I must do, and I have done, is told all peers and MPs, look, if you think you have any information about this, and certainly if the you know, come forward to the police. And, of course, if the police ask you for any information,
yes,
bring that forward. But if it... You know,
respectfully, you've not answered the... Why not hold your own inquiry?
Because there's no... You suggest that it might be some treasure trove of documents the Liberal Democrats hold about the activity of a man who got up to these things, apparently, before he was even a Liberal, yet alone Liberal Democrat.
During the time he was a Liberal as well.
Well, but don't you think that the only people who can deliver justice are the police? Mm. I mean, I'm sort of surprised sometimes when people say that someone else should deliver. It is for the police to do so, and it is for everybody else to make information available to the police. And that, of course, is what I have said as leader of the Liberal Democrats. Anybody who has any recollection or any information about that era, however many years ago, should make that information available to the police. But I'm not going to somehow elevate a political party to replace the police. Only the police can do that job for us. They clearly didn't do so in the past. We need to know why not, but we now need to make sure that if anybody has any information which is of use to the police, it is provided to them.
We move to other calls. Cara in Covent Garden is through to Nick Clegg. Go ahead, Cara.
Good morning. I was reading the polls, and yesterday the Conservatives were predicted to win 14 marginal constituencies from you in the Southwest. How are you still staying positive?
Oh, because polls like that are just absolute baloney. I think that particular poll, Cara, would you believe it? I mean, honestly, this bogus science from some of this stuff is just extraordinary. That poll, I think, polled the equivalent of 72 people per constituency without even mentioning the MPs' names or the candidates' names. I mean, it's completely...
So you've got no problems in your heartland?
We've got real contests on our hands, which is great. You should have contests. I enjoy campaigning. I much prefer being out campaigning than... I don't know, arguing with George Osborne in an office in Whitehall. But we will win so many more seats than this endless cottage industry of sort of pessimistic punditry allows for. But in this particular case, since you asked, Cara, that was a poll which, as I say, you ask 70 people out of 60-odd thousand without even mentioning the names of the people who are actually going to be on the ballot paper. I have this old-fashioned view that if you want to find out or try and guess how people might...
The Congress poll asked 1,000 voters across 14 constituencies. It's not 72 people, it's 1,000 people.
No, they asked across the whole of the South West, and if you average it out across those 14 seats, it's about 72 people per seat.
After 5 years in government, don't you think you should be doing a lot better?
Well, I think we're doing very well, Cara, in the areas where people get to hear our side of the story. But if you want us to do even better still, Cara, which I agree, then all you need to do is vote for your local Liberal Democrat candidate.
This is Nick Ferrari. More highlights of my week on breakfast after the news. This is LBC.